So this week, I'm really happy to welcome Sam Krieg to give the Perimeter Quantum Information Seminar. So Sam might be a familiar face to some of you. He was actually a PSI student in 2018 to 2019. And he's now a PhD student at Stanford, where his supervisor is Patrick Hayden. So please take it away, Sam.
Thank you very much. Okay, so thank you everyone for coming. I'm going to be talking a little bit about holographic codes, and in particular, thinking about whether they might be useful for practical purposes in fault-tolerant quantum computing. So as the title suggests, I'm going to show a restriction that kind of limits their ability to do this job. So this is the outline that I'm going to be working with. I'm going to give you a bit of background and hopefully motivate the topic a bit before talking about how it is that we're able to restrict fault-tolerant logical gates. I'll then show how we do this in a specific example of a holographic code before arguing in general principles that the same kind of reasoning should apply to basically any holographic code. And this might seem a little bit backwards, that at the end I'm going to talk about what exactly makes a code holographic, but part of the reason for that is that it's still a little bit unclear how best to define what a holographic code is. Any of the reasonable definitions that you might come up with kind of exclude the most famous examples. So I'll come back to that at the end. So to begin with, let me talk about holographic codes a little bit in case you're not familiar. So the first paper introducing them was by Preskill, Yoshida, Harlow, and Pastowski. And it's known as HAPI because of an anagram of these author initials. And when we talk about holographic codes, in general, what we mean is codes that are similar to and in some way inspired by HAPI, which was the prototype. And this original code was mainly motivated by trying to better understand quantum gravity, in particular, theories of holography, or ADS-CFT. And so it was useful because it provided a concrete toy model where you have a lot of control, it's discrete, everything's well-behaved, and you can calculate things a little more explicitly or look into the properties a bit more clearly than quantum field theories and more complicated theories like that. But one thing that some recent works have been finding is that, in fact, you can find modifications of HAPI that have pretty good error thresholds comparable to that of the surface code, if that means anything to you. And so this kind of opens up the idea that maybe these codes might actually play a role in fault-tolerant quantum computing and be useful for practical purposes. They've got another desirable feature potentially for some applications, which I find interesting, which is that the degrees of freedom encoded in a holographic code kind of have this hierarchical structure where some degrees of freedom are better protected than others. And so it kind of is a bit reminiscent of like a long versus short-term memory structure, where maybe that might be useful if you actually want to have these different levels of protection for different degrees of freedom. But there's still a lot of open questions, and this bigger question of can they actually be useful is something that the work I'm going to talk about with my co-authors, Kafir, Vlad, and Dom, is trying to contribute towards answering. So let me talk about fault-tolerant logical gates. Now, I've said that these holographic codes can have good error thresholds. They can protect from noise quite well, but that's not all we want for quantum computing. We would also like to be able to actually manipulate the encoded information without disrupting our protection from noise. So if we want to apply some logical unitary UL to our encoded state here, V is my isometry that maps from the logical state to the physical state, which I can write in a little tensor network diagram here, then what I would like to do is apply some code space preserving operator. So that'll be some operator here. It preserves the code space, meaning it doesn't, it actually has a well-defined logical action in the first place. And I would like that to be equivalent to if I had taken my state psi, first acted with some logical operation, and then encoded it as before, like this. But of course, the problem is if just before I apply this U gate, some error occurs here, then if my U doesn't have any special structure to it, that noise can corrupt the entire system. If it entangles all of my degrees of freedom, I may end up having some very uncontrollable error on the output. And even if I could correct that initial error, the output state is going to be beyond hope of actually recovering. So what we would like to do is find some special type of gate U that doesn't have this problem. The most straightforward one would be a transversal gate, which means a tensor product of operators on individual subsystems. Because in that case, an error remains localized and it can still be corrected even if it occurs just before we apply our gate. So it would be nice if I can have this be equal. But of course, for a given code, you're not necessarily going to be able to do that for every logical operation UL. And the set of gates for which you can, I'm going to call the transversal gate set. Okay? So the transversal gate set is all of those ULs for a given encoding isomorphic V, such that there exists a code space preserving transversal operator that implements that gate. And while this is the simplest example, there are others as well, which the results that I'm going to talk about of this work also apply to. In particular, you might imagine some local circuit that isn't too deep, so that in this case, you know, maybe it entangles some degrees of freedom, but in a controlled way, so that if we can correct two qubit errors, then my error is allowed to propagate like this and it would still be manageable. But I'm going to mainly focus on the transversal case just because it's simpler. And so let's talk about transversal gate sets. The ideal scenario, of course, would be that we can do any unitary we like in this way. That would make everything very easy. But of course, life is not so simple. And the Easton-Nil theorem says that the transversal gate set cannot be universal. In fact, it says that it must be a finite set of gates. So even stronger than that. And that's provided your code can at least correct some local errors. So this is kind of the big problem of fault-tolerant quantum computing, and we need strategies to try to work around it. One thing you can do is take two codes, which have different transversal gate sets, which together can be used to generate an arbitrary unitary, at least up to some approximate error. And so then you go to one code, you apply transversal gate sets, transversal gates from that set, and then where necessary, if you can, you can fault tolerantly code switch into the other code to apply those gates from its transversal gate set. So this is one way that you can still get universal fault tolerant quantum computation, even despite the Easton-Nil theorem. In those cases, a very common way of doing this is the following recipe, which is one code will have the Clifford group as its transversal gate set, which is a particular group of operators that I'll come back to. And then the other one just needs any one qubit, any one gate from outside that set. That's enough to make a universal gate set. So if this is the strategy you've got in mind, then it's important to ask which codes can implement transversal non-Clifford gates. And there are restrictions that apply to broad families of codes saying that they cannot actually do this. The original and most the original one of these was by Bravi and Koenig in 2013, which basically said that any 2D topological stabilizer code is unable to transversally implement a non-Clifford gate. It was generalized to a slightly broader family called subsystem stabilizer codes, topological still, by Pastowski and Yoshida, that being Benny Yoshida based EOPI. And what our work does is apply this to a new family called holographic subsystem stabilizer codes. And all of these work with the same, I'm going to call it the core lemma, which is the technique that we use to actually make these kinds of restrictions. And it comes from this Bravi-Koenig paper here. So I'm going to start by introducing that technique and then show how we can apply it to holographic codes. So that's a bit of background. Now I'm going to jump into that particular technique that I've mentioned. So just in case you're rusty or you haven't heard it before, a stabilizer code is one where we have some particular decomposition of the physical space into qubits with a Pauli group defined as tensor products of Paulis on each site plus some global phases. And then we're going to define our code space as being the simultaneous plus one eigenspace of some subgroup S of those palis. Now, for this to be a sensible definition, we need a couple of requirements on S. It needs to be abelian. All the elements commute so that they actually share a simultaneous eigenspace. And also, we need to make sure that the negative identity is not in S, because if that were the case, there wouldn't be any plus one eigenstates of that particular element. And so we would have a trivial code space, which isn't much fun. Now, why am I talking about stabilizer codes? You might have noticed in the title, I'm making a claim here about holographic stabilizer codes. And there's a few reasons why I'm restricting to that particular case. The first is most holographic codes are stabilizer codes. The prototype, Happy, and many of the ones inspired by it are stabilizer codes. Second reason is that because of the additional algebraic structure from this Pauli group and the particular relationship that the code space has with it, that allows us to do a lot more that you can't do so easily in general codes. There's a lot of decoding algorithms and so on that we can only apply to stabilizer codes. So if we're going to do things, if we're going to find a holographic code that has a practical application, it's likely to be a stabilizer code for that reason. And the third is what I'm going to get at in this slide, which is without having a stabilizer structure to your code, it actually, there isn't really a natural way for a Clifford group to arise in the first place. So it's because of this relationship with the Pauli group that we get some canonical definition of a Clifford group in the first place. Why is that? That's because in stabilizer codes, we can always choose a basis for our logical system, our code space, if you like. We can always choose a decomposition into qubits and a local basis for each qubit, such that the Pauli operators there are implemented by code space preserving physical Paulis. So we have this nice connection between physical Paulis and logical Paulis, which we can always do in a stabilizer code. And because of that, we can actually make sense of the logical Cliffords, which are defined in terms of the logical Paulis as follows. It's the set of all unitary logical operators such that this kind of group commutator here for any Pauli in the logical Pauli group, we need this to still be a logical Pauli. Now, this might be, sometimes you see this definition without this last little P dagger here, but it's equivalent, so don't worry about that. Okay, so that's the third reason is, we need stabilizer codes so that we can actually make sense of that part. Now, we need one more ingredient because nothing I've said so far actually says anything about the quality of this code or its error correction capabilities. And as we saw with Easton Nil, to make a restriction on transversal gate sets, you usually need to show that it has some minimum of coding quality in some way. And the way that that's going to show up in this particular lemma is via correctable regions. So a region of the physical space, by which I mean some subset of the qubits or some subsystem, is going to be correctable if the encoded state can still be recovered even if we were to erase that region R, okay? And with that definition, we can now state the core lemma, which is the main tool we're going to use to make all of these restrictions in the rest of this talk. And it's as follows. If we have some unitary code space preserving transversal operator U in our stabilizer code, and the physical space can be broken up into three correctable regions, then we know that that unitary must implement a logical Clifford element. I'm not going to prove this here, although the proof is not too complicated and it's quite neat. So feel free to look into it in the Bravi-Koenig paper if you're interested. It's quite a cute little proof. So this is basically what we need now. If we can show the existence of three correctable regions that partition the physical space, then we're done. We've excluded the possibility of transversal non-Cliffords. The one thing that we would like to do now is just find a slightly easier way of characterizing correctable regions, because this erasure definition is not the nicest to work with. Fortunately, we can rephrase it in another way, I think using the Miller-Flamm error correction conditions. You can frame it in the following way. A region is correctable if and only if every logical operator can be implemented by something on the complement RC. So the physical intuition for this is we can recover for the erasure of R if every observable of the encoded information can be implemented on R complement. That's like our measurement that actually detects the logical operator or the logical observable AL on the input to the coding isometry. So these two are equivalent definitions, and the second one's going to be much more useful, particularly for holographic codes, as we'll see. Okay, so let's apply it to a holographic code. In particular, I'm going to start with a special case of the Happy family of codes. Happy is built out of perfect tenses, which I'm going to introduce briefly now and try to motivate a little bit. So we have this property for isometries that you can always take some operator on the input to an isometry and push it through to form an operator on the output. The way that you define this is you can just write U equals V followed by a U followed by V dagger, and that will always do the job. This should be UL. There we go. Now, one thing we could require of our coding isometry, might seem like a weird requirement, is if I bend some of these legs around, I can reinterpret this thing as being a matrix from 3 qubits to 3 qubits. This is might be familiar if you have seen tensor network notation before. But if that thing is a unitary, then I can also push operators around in different ways. I can take some operator that acts on the input as well as two of the output legs, and I can push it into something that acts on these three output legs here. So the point of this is, if we have lots of rearranging of legs that allow us to do this, then some tensor network built out of this tensor, this six-legged tensor, will be able to push operators around very freely, and that will help us when constructing correctable regions because of that characterization I gave, that it's about being able to implement an operator in a particular region of the physical space. We can use it to demonstrate that kind of behavior. So with that in mind, we're going to define a perfect tensor as a tensor which will always form a unitary for any grouping of three input legs and three output legs of the tensor. And that means we can always push an operator from any three legs to any three others. And with that in mind, we can then construct codes that are going to have reasonable error correction properties. Okay, so maybe this will make more sense with a concrete example. Here's what an example of a happy code looks like. We have in here the bulk system or the logical system. As I said, this is inspired by holography. So there's this bulk boundary, which corresponds to logical physical. And this red dot here represents a leg sticking out of the page towards us as a logical input leg. Then we have lots of copies of this six-legged tensor, which has this property that I stated here. I kind of skipped over this. The fact that that tensor exists at all is kind of surprising, but it does. And in fact, you can just take the encoding isometry of the 5-qubit code, and that has this property, which is, quite a surprise. And then we can use that tensor, which is the one that they use in the Happy paper, to construct these networks. And now if I have some logical operation acting on my logical input, I can use these pushing rules to say, okay, let's interpret these three legs here as inputs and these three as outputs. Then I can push my operator acting here, and I guess the identity here and here, into some operator acting on these three legs here. So that looks like this. Now I can repeat this process on the next set of perfect tensors to push it a little bit further out. And I end up with something acting on this boundary region here for any logical operator that I might want to start with. So what that means is if I can construct all of the logical information on this region, then the complement to that region must be correctable, okay? And that's the highlighted region shown here, plus these little bits. Of course, if we can correct the erasure of a big region, we can also correct for the erasure of any smaller subregion. So I can also just say, you know what, this region here is correctable. So remember our task for the core lemma is we need to divide the physical space into three correctable regions. And to do that, we're just going to repeat this process, but push in like a different angle each time. So we can do it again, facing a different way, like this, to show that this region here is correctable. And we can do it again in some other direction to show that this region is correctable. And what we've done is partitioned the boundary into these three correctable regions, which means, according to the core lemma, there is no transversal non-Cliffords. We are unable to transversally implement a non-Clifford gate on this qubit. So that's the idea. But of course, I've just shown you an example by drawing arrows and pushing things around. And the question, the natural question to ask is this some special property of this particular example I showed you? Or is there a reason that we should expect this to always hold for a code which claims to model holography? And our claim is the latter. There is some underlying reason for it. Okay, so I'm going to try to argue that a particular information theoretic property of holography itself, that is ADS-CFT, gives rise to this ability to construct three correctable regions in any toy model that claims to represent it, at least somewhat accurately.
Sam, could I just stop you quickly, ask a question about the previous slide? So,
of course.
Is there any like restriction on the overlaps of these correctable regions? Like,
so because of that's a good question. Now, I mentioned that if you have a region being correctable, then any smaller subregion is also correctable. And so although it might concern you that I've got these overlaps here, I could just restrict this green one to this and the red one back to here and so on with each of the other overlaps and say, okay, but those smaller subregions are still correctable. And so it can actually be a partition. Yeah, this is even stronger than that. And it turns out that those overlaps will be useful down the track. So I'll come back to that, but excellent question.
Okay, thanks.
That's why I left them in, is because they can actually help us out. Okay, so the property that I'm going to claim leads to these this ability to construct these three correctable regions is something called complementary recovery. Okay, so to introduce this concept, I need to add a little bit more detail to my holographic code examples. You see, the one that I showed you was very special in that it had only one logical input. But in general, I can have a more complicated code that has a lot of different inputs like this one here. And then the logical space has all of these different degrees of freedom, and the physical space is on the boundary still as it was before. But the problem here is that although this qubit here deep in the bulk is very well protected from noise, the ones towards the edge are not so well protected. In fact, I could have an error occur on just these three qubits up here that would apply a non-trivial logical operation to this bulk qubit here. So although we've added a lot of extra qubits, the quality of protection that those outer ones have is quite bad. So what we would like to do in order to still describe this as a useful code is basically define some division into two subsystems of these bulk degrees of freedom, a logical subsystem and a junk subsystem, also called sometimes a gauge subsystem. And then the idea is going to be, we're not going to worry about things that corrupt this information here, as long as we still preserve the information encoded in HL. And so here I've drawn some deeper bulk qubits, which are better protected from noise and to be the logical subsystem that we actually care about. So there's a whole formalism for this, which is called the subsystem stabilizer formalism. And it has a lot of interesting properties. But one thing that we want to know is, do we still have something like the core lemma? And the answer is yes, we do. It holds because it was shown by Pastowski and Yoshida in their paper. And it goes something like this. It's very similar to before with two major differences. The first one is, just like we want code space preserving operators so that it has a sensible, well-defined action on the code space, we also need it to act in a well-defined way on the logical subsystem. If it entangles HL with HJ, the logical with the junk subsystem, then it risks corrupting our logical subsystem with some of the noisy, badly protected info in HJ, the junk subsystem. So we're going to require, for it to even make sense as a logical operation, that it has a tensor product form acting on UL and UJ. And then the second difference to note here compared to the other one is correctability is now a relative property. If I erase some region, I probably can't correct all of the bulk, but the question we want to ask is, can I correct HL? Can I recover the information encoded in HL? And so that's why we're going to define correctability with respect to HL. Another way to put that, as before, is if I take operators that act on the just HL, can I push those through to the complementary region, RC? But with those in mind, we can still proceed as before. And now to get to complementary recovery, we just need one more definition, which is the entanglement wedge. This name comes from holography, but it's actually well-defined for any subsystem code, which is one of the things that we point out in our paper. So we can define this as being a map on a region R that gives the union of all encoded subsystems with respect to which our complement is correctable. So here's a picture for that. We have here some region R in the physical boundary space, and its entanglement wedge is this bulk region here. So each of these points is associated with some algebra of operators in space-time in the full theory of ADS-CFT, but in our discrete toy models, we're going to have some points just represent individual qubits. And so that individual qubit is part of the entanglement wedge of R if and only if R complement is correctable with respect to X. Or in other words, if and only if we can reconstruct the full algebra of operators on this region R. So that's the entanglement wedge. And the way that I've drawn it here is a bit suggestive of what complementary recovery is, which is this claim that the entanglement wedge of R and the entanglement wedge of R complement fill out the entire bulk space. There's no gap here between the red and the blue regions. That is a property that holography obeys and that we might expect for a holographic code to also capture in this toy model. So if it does satisfy this region, this property for every region, then we can certainly show the existence of the three correctable regions from that. And I'll give you that argument now. After first showing you what complementary recovery looks like in a discrete example of Happy. So here, the entanglement wedge is all of this region R, which is the physical qubits here. The entanglement wedge is going to be every logical qubit whose operators can all be pushed outwards into this boundary region R. So you can see here, everything in red can be pushed in that way out to the boundary region, and everything in yellow can be pushed out towards the yellow boundary region R complement, which is this thing. And so that shows that this region R does obey complementary recovery. So we know that it can happen in these toy models as well, in Happy. Okay, so given complementary recovery for every region, how can we construct these three correctable regions? This is the procedure. First, we pick a qubit to label as our logical system, L. Then we're going to find the smallest non-correctable region, R. In this example, that's this yellow region here, and its entanglement wedge is also shown in yellow here. That's the smallest non-correctable region with respect to that subsystem, L. Now, if we break it into two smaller regions, which are these ones here, they must be correctable because they're smaller than the smallest non-correctable region. So we've got two correctable regions. All we need to complete the core lemma is to show that this blue region is also correctable. That would seal the deal. Unfortunately, complementary recovery allows us to do exactly that. And here's the reasoning. Because this region R is non-correctable, that means that L cannot be in the entanglement wedge of its complement. Otherwise, it would be correctable. because of complementary recovery, anything not in the entanglement wedge of the complement is in the entanglement wedge of the region itself. So we know that as drawn here, this qubit is indeed in the yellow entanglement wedge. Therefore, this region in blue, R complement, is correctable with respect to L. And we've completed the proof to show that because the physical system partitions into three correctable regions, there must not be any transversal non-Cliffords. That's really like the central argument of our work. Please let me know if you have any questions or anything about that, because I think that it's worth pausing here to make sure that that makes sense. So one thing to notice here is that we only used complementary recovery on the region R. So we don't need it to apply for every region, which is nice, because as I'm about to show you, that doesn't actually always hold. So let's talk about what makes a code holographic. You might be tempted to define it as being a code that always obeys complementary recovery. And in fact, there have been some papers where people do that. The problem with this definition is that it excludes the prototypical example, happy. Let me show you. I showed you this example before of a region in a happy code that does obey complementary recovery, but you can easily construct regions that don't. In fact, here, the red and yellow regions, they're very disconnected and nasty, but they actually both have empty entanglement wedges. None of these qubits can have all of their operators reconstructed on the corresponding boundary regions. You might think that that's a little bit of a forced example, but I can do it even with connected boundary regions. If I just slightly tweak the regions from that first example, you can see here that things are going to go wrong as well. If I try to take the operators acting on one of these two qubits in the gap and I push it towards the yellow region, I'm going to have to go like this to push it to three legs. Then I have to push to these three. And you can see that no matter what I do, I'm going to end up overflowing to the red region as well. And same goes if I push from here to begin with. You can't push to just yellow or red. And so these are in neither entanglement wedge, and complementary recovery fails, even for this nice connected region. So it becomes hard to actually precisely state what is it that makes a code holographic. And what do we do for our line of reasoning if R doesn't satisfy complementary recovery? Fortunately, we just need one region to satisfy it, as I mentioned before. And in fact, if we go back, what did I use about this region R? I said it was the smallest non-correctable region, but I didn't need that to be the case, right? All I needed was to make sure that if it breaks up into two smaller regions, that both of those are correctable. So it would have been fine for me to pick R as any region that is less than twice the size of the smallest non-correctable region. As long as I have that, then its two subdivisions have to be correctable. So all I need to make this argument work is just one region in some range of sizes from the smallest to double the smallest non-correctable region to obey complementary recovery. And that would be enough to make the reasoning work. So it's quite robust. In fact, I can even apply this reasoning even if no regions follow complementary recovery. I just need something to almost satisfy complementary recovery, like this example here. And that's where this overlap that I mentioned that Michael asked about earlier on comes back into play. Because of that extra overlap, I can actually just expand one of my regions slightly so that its entanglement wedge does include that gap. And now I'm able to continue with all of the reasoning as before to show that those three regions must exist. So there's a few ways that we extend these results in the paper that I'm not going to go into detail in here. One of them is what I just mentioned, that we can have even with almost complementary recovery holding. I was talking about an individual qubit in the bulk, but we can also generalize that to sufficiently small bulk regions. So you can rule out non-Cliffords acting even if they couple two adjacent qubits or something like that. There's also some holographic codes that have been defined that use approximate encodings, and we can generalize to those cases as well to show that you can't implement anything that's too close to a Clifford. Sorry, you can only implement things that are particularly close to a Clifford. And as I mentioned at the beginning, transversal gates are not the end of the story. We also have locality preserving gates. So that's like some short depth local circuit. And if that circuit is sufficiently shallow, then our reasoning will still work there as well. And we also apply to some particular codes where I've been talking about regions as being synonymous with subsystems. That doesn't need to be the case. You can have it be that they're associated with an algebra of operators that is not the algebra of operators on any local subsystem. And even in a particular family of codes that generalize these ideas in that way, we can still apply the central argument to that family of codes as well. But of course, I want to come back to this question of what makes a code holographic, and it's still unclear. What we tried to do in this work is to show that anything which kind of even sometimes almost has this particular property of complementary recovery should follow this restriction. But I think that we really need a better definition of what it means for a code to be holographic. We have a very clear definition for topological stabilizer codes, which is the other main family that I mentioned existing results are already known for. And yeah, I think that that would be something that would be very useful in making these kinds of sweeping general statements that we're trying to make here. I mean, if we could crystallize exactly what constitutes a holographic code. But to wrap up, what we've shown is that if holographic codes can actually play a role in some fault-tolerant quantum computing strategy, it's either going to need some other way of implementing non-Clifford gates that isn't just transversal or locality-preserving gates, or it needs to somehow circumvent restrictions of this work. So it must be locality-preserving, but it's a particularly deep circuit, or maybe it has particularly large bulk regions that it couples all together at once in a way that circumvents the restrictions that we impose here. I think that the first of those two data points is more likely, in my opinion. Still looking for a precise definition. And then a couple of other little auxiliary results that we picked up along the way. I thought it was quite interesting that we can define an entanglement wedge map for any subsystem code without any additional requirements. And that kind of fits in with a few other results that people have found where you can show certain like holographic properties from just information theoretic starting points. And then, although I didn't discuss the technical details here, when you go from stabilizer codes to stabilizer subsystem codes, the correctability properties of different regions becomes a whole lot more complicated. I just talked about correctability, but there's actually something of a zoo of different properties, and we need only weaker things than correctability. You need two regions to be one thing and one region to be another thing. And it gets a little bit messy, but we found a few little results there and kind of summed up what's known about the relationship between those different properties. So that's all I have to say. These are my references. Thank you very much for listening. And I will be happy to answer any questions that people have.
Great. Let's all thank Sam for a really nice talk. And yeah, I can open up to questions. Well, maybe I can get us started. So,
sure.
You said about these results, they apply to kind of sufficiently small bulk regions. Can you say anything more precise about that?
Yeah, I can. So let's go back here. Let me talk about this step. So the main place where we use the only place that we use the fact that it was a single qubit in this reasoning is when we are making this argument here with complementary recovery. I said that because this system is not in the entanglement wedge of R complement, it must be an entanglement wedge of R. Now that need not be true if your system is divisible. It might be that it straddles the boundary between these two entanglement wedges, even if complementary recovery is satisfied. But what you can do is, let's suppose that that's the case, right? Let's suppose that I have some region here that kind of straddles the boundary. Then what I can do with R is I can stretch R a bit. I can expand it on either side so that it is still smaller than twice the size of the smallest non-correctable region. And I just need to be able to do that in such a way that the entanglement wedge now includes my entire logical region. And as long as I can do that, then the complement that's still left over will be correctable. And when I break it into two, these will still be correctable as well. So that's what the procedure looks like for a finite region. Now, quantifying how much I need to spread this out by in order to capture that extra bit of the bulk in your entanglement wedge, that's a bit tricky. And it kind of comes down to requiring some sort of smoothness of the entanglement wedge map. It's actually like a one-directional smoothness. So there are discontinuities in the entanglement wedge map, but they always go in a direction that isn't a problem for this line of reasoning. It's a little confusing, but so that's what we require. And it's kind of the best way to really capture, complementary recovery is a very information theoretic property, but it doesn't capture the geometry of the code. So to talk about locality preserving gates, you really need to kind of add in some extra structure, some extra details about the geometric properties of the code. And that's where this smoothness of the entanglement wedge map is kind of how that geometric structure is manifested. And it allows us to say that for a sufficiently small extension into the bulk here, there will be some sufficiently small extension in the boundary that captures it. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I think so.
Does that answer the question?
Yeah. I think I have an idea. I have to check the paper for the details. But thank you. I mean, I also have some other questions, but maybe does anyone else have any questions?
Go ahead with yours, I suppose.
Yeah. These codes, these holographic codes, they're kind of like constant rate codes, right? But then with like the distances depends on where you are in the bulk, it'll be worse the closer you are to the boundary, right?
That's right.
Yeah, it's kind of interesting because these this Brabe-Koenig kind of technique is like really nice and like obviously being applied to topological codes, but then you've got your paper and then also some other work. People have been sort of applying these kind of techniques to these, you guys, to holographic codes, and other people to these these hypergraph product codes. So I just kind of was wondering about like your argument here is very much kind of inspired by the concepts from this ADS-CFT stuff, and like what other kind of codes do you think this complementary recovery kind of notion, you said you defined it for arbitrary subsystem codes, do you think it's a useful concept for looking at other families of codes beyond holographic codes, and have you kind of thought about where in what other codes it holds as a concept?
Right.
And it's true.
So there's a very interesting paper by Daniel Harlow showing that if you have complementary recovery, then your code already captures a number of holographic properties. So I don't know if you're familiar with the Ryu-Takayanagi formula, but this paper shows that any code that has complementary recovery obeys something that looks a bit like a Ryu-Takayanagi formula. So because of that, I feel that complementary recovery, a code satisfying complementary recovery is already kind of a holographic code in and of itself. And so, I suppose it would be interesting to see if maybe there are some other codes out there already that have that property and so can be thought of as holographic codes. I'm not aware of any other than the ones that are deliberately built to be holographic. And it kind of makes sense because it is quite a stringent requirement. It's a bit of an odd requirement to make if you're just thinking from first principles about a code, saying that if I can recover this information on this region, then I can recover the other information on the other region. It's a bit weird.
And I guess, this makes sense because you were saying that in some ways it's too strong because you have, your result is more general than this. Okay.
Yeah, exactly. I actually don't know of any The only code I know of that obeys complementary recovery for every connected region, like that's an even weaker requirement. I'm just saying, as long as the region's connected, it has to obey complementary recovery. The only code I know of that actually has that property is not a stabilizer code at all. It's this random tensor network construction. It's kind of the one non-stabilizer holographic code that I know of. So yeah, if you were to just use complementary recovery as your definition, there would be no known holographic stabilizer codes.
Okay, thanks.
Any other questions from you or anyone else, Michael?
Yeah, from anyone else, probably better. But, there's been as you said, like you alluded to, there's been this work on decoding these codes and people trying to think about them as being, you know, used in maybe in an architecture for fault tolerant quantum computation. So obviously your results like put some restrictions on that, but as you said, there's like very well known ways around kind of not being able to do Clifford gates, non-Clifford gates, sorry, in your code, which people have looked at before. Have you thought about kind of the ways around this no-go theorem? Have you thought maybe is there a kind of a technique from topological code you think is well suited to these codes or something like that?
I haven't put a lot of thought into it. I was actually, when making these slides, I was thinking about this a bit, whether like maybe you can apply a magic state distillation protocol to kind of do this approach. But yeah, I haven't thought through any of the details about whether that would work, whether there would be any obstacles to it.
Yeah, I mean, speaking a bit speculatively here, but there's the structure you've got in those codes of like this hierarchy of protection sometimes reminds me of the thing in magic states where, you know, you have like some noisier things, you try and distill them to lower noise things. And I kind of sometimes wondered if that might be something could be useful, I never thought about it seriously.
I think that's another thing that you can, so this is something that one of my co-authors, Dom, was thinking about, Dom Williamson. Mm-hmm. And I remember him saying that these codes, that these results that we have seem to indicate that they probably wouldn't be useful for magic state distillation, even though there is this reminiscent, like tree-like structure to the encoder degrees of freedom. So
yeah, I mean,
what I was thinking of is, you know, there's kind of two things here. You can either use holographic codes to do magic state distillation, which is what he seems to think is going to be hard because of these results from this work. Or the thing that I was talking about was you use magic state distillation and then you feed the output of that into a holographic code.
Yeah. I suppose maybe like in magic states, like I don't know. I don't know what Dom was thinking. But like I could see one way to do magic state distillation is if you have a non-Clifford gate, then that's like a, and then there's a protocol you can do, which basically uses that fact. But there's another way where you like measure like Clifford operators. So if there's like, maybe if just because a code doesn't have non-Clifford gates doesn't mean it necessarily isn't useful for magic states, I think.
Okay.
But I don't know if that would like apply in this case.
I don't know as much about that, which is why I'm just mentioning what I heard.
But no, it's definitely, I don't know. This is it's really nice to see like these results on what you can actually do with these codes. So yeah, thanks again for this talk.
No worries.
Yeah. So last chance for anyone else to ask questions. Okay. Well, let's all thank Sam once again for a really nice talk.